Talking transfers today, people. I think K-State really needs to hit the transfer market this offseason. It appears that Bruce Weber is going to be back. If that's the case, I'd be wanting some answers if I were Gene Taylor on how exactly the three-point shooting is going to improve from being 320th in the country and how the turnover percentage is going to improve from being 327th. And to me, the only way to solve at least one of those two problems, the three-point shooting, is to hit the transfer market and get somebody in here who can shoot. Logan Landers, that they have already coming in, Maximus Edwards, like, I don't feel confident in either two of those guys, like, being high enough impact next year right away to dramatically increase K-State's three-point shooting percentage. And outside of that, we're talking about Luke Kasubke, 24%, Dejuan Gordon, 21%, Antonio Gordon, 17%, Selton Miguel, 24%, even McGurl on the season is like 33%, and in Big 12 play, it's 30.5%. That's not very good. This team in the Big 12 is 5% worse from three-point range than the ninth-place team in the conference, which is, that is obscene. That is, it may not, like 5% to the untrained ear, may not seem like a lot. That is a ton. There's like less than a percentage point then between ninth and fifth. So it's not, there's typically not nearly that much variance between there. It has been a dreadful shooting team. And I don't think it's fair to say, hey, you're going to be able to go get somebody to improve your, well, I shouldn't phrase it like that. To say you're going to be able to turn around this roster to become that much better at shooting the three, when I've really only seen it happen with two guys, Shane Southwell and Wesley Owundu, in their time here at K-State. Like, it's hard to squeeze blood out of a turnip. How many times have we covered that ground here on this very program before? Shout out to those of you who have been listening long enough to remember the show where we took calls on turnips. It's hard to squeeze blood out of a turnip. It's hard to ask a cat to bark. And that, I feel like, is what you're doing if you're trying to tell this roster to get significantly better at shooting the three next year. So the answer to me becomes the transfer market, because there are going to be so many available. We're already talking upwards of 700 per year. It's going to be higher this year with the one-year penalty-free transfer coming up, and the fact that there's just going to be more disgruntled athletes because of the pandemic circumstances that this year has put everybody through. We saw it happen during football. I'd imagine we see it happen during basketball. And the part that's concerning to me about this, about what may or may not happen and whether or not this staff will take advantage of that and really go in earnest, try to hit the portal to bring somebody in who can actually put the ball in the damn net, is that we just have not seen them do very much of that at all throughout the course of Bruce Weber's time here. And even over the last 5 years is really where I narrowed down the numbers to on this, because that's when things have started to explode big time. You know, like 5 years ago, we were still sitting here talking about Fred Hoiberg and Iowa State and how much they were utilizing transfers. And like, that was a big story because they had a lot of success with it and nobody else was doing it to that extent, like to that level. It wasn't nearly as common at that point as it is now in college hoops. So now, in the last 5 years, the numbers have jumped up to where we're talking about over 700 in the portal per year. And in the last 5 years, Bruce Weber has only taken three transfers. One of those being, I say it's generous of me to consider it three, because one of them was Justin Edwards, who was taken obviously a couple of years before that, but he had played technically, so I counted him. But there are only three players who were transfers from other schools, not junior college transfers, but just guys that would have been in the transfer portal, quote-unquote. There are only three in the last 5 years. In 2019, the last year I could find complete data, there were 110 teams in college basketball that had three-plus transfers on their roster. Three-plus that have been in the portal. That's like a third of college basketball had as many in 1 year in 2019 as Bruce has taken and had on his roster in the past five. So it's not something that they have been very inclined to do. Now, the reasoning for that, I mean, they did obviously for a chunk of that have a good core and nucleus to build around. That was Dean Berry and Cam, and that turn into what they did. But by the way, a big part of that was Justin Edwards being there at the beginning to help buoy that team to at least a 5-win Big 12 season and playing close in a lot of games when they were freshmen. And we've discussed that ad nauseum here on the show this year. How this group has not had that. They have not had enough around them to supplement them, to give them confidence, to get them off on the right foot. Like, they're starting from further behind because those guys have not been there. So they did actually help in that instance, having Justin Edwards. And it's just becoming increasingly obvious in college basketball that if you are not Kansas, if you're not Texas, like, those are the two schools in the Big 12 that have not really had to do a whole lot of this because they can go recruit whatever talent it is that they want. But if you want to compete at the highest of levels and be consistently very competitive in the league right now and in a Power 5 league at the level K-State wants to be at, you have to go play the transfer market more than K-State is right now, especially when you go through something like K-State did last year where you're losing 9 players and you have 9 open spots to fill and you're going to be that young. Like, just there's not another option, really. Because there's not time anymore. There's not time to sit around and say, hey, we're going to wait for this group to 3 years down the road all of a sudden be a tournament team. Like, a 3-year rebuild is far too long when there are quicker options available. Like, trying to sit around and say, hey, you know, I mean, this group will make the tournament in 2023. 3.5-year rebuild on this deal. To me, that's just, it's like you're being stubborn. This is not something I would do because I'm far from being manly enough for this. But stereotype of men, right? You're not going to ask for directions. Might not want to use the Google Maps. I know how to get there, and I'm going to figure this out. Come hell or high water, I'm figuring this out. We could probably get there faster if you would, you know, in the olden days, be willing to ask for directions. Now, just throw on the Google Maps, and you can figure it out like that. You know, like, there's a quicker option here to get to from point A to point B, and that is with transfers. Instead of having to sit there and just think you can remember it all and try and go through in your head and guess and check and all that, like, there's a quicker option here. Scott Drew, who's playing right now, let me see if... check this Baylor score. Baylor is leading West Virginia by 5 in Morgantown. They're 18-1. They're 10-1 in the league. They are the number 3 team in the country. All right. That team has 4 transfers in their rotation. 4 of the top 9 players for Scott Drew right now are transfers. Baylor has utilized the transfer market to perfection to build the team that they have right now. And they've done some of both. They have an Auburn transfer, and they have transfers from lower levels. Like, they've gone out and taken the productive kid at the mid-major to low-major level. They've also taken the high-major. They've had success doing it both ways. K-State just beat Oklahoma, yes, but Oklahoma's had a lot of success this year. Lon Kruger, ever since his dip about 4 years ago to where they were a 5-13 team in the league, has been in the tournament, has been at least an 8-win team in the league because they've been able to infuse the program with some transfers. They have 3 that are playing in their main rotation right now. One of them is a borderline Big 12 Player of the Year candidate in Austin Reeves. Texas Tech has 3. Like, everybody around here wants to fawn over Chris Beard, and rightfully so. Chris Beard is great. He's awesome. He's somebody that's used transfers a lot. The guy damn near won a national championship at Texas Tech by plugging in some really high-level transfers. And Tariq Owens and Matt Mooney, and God, did they even maybe have another one on that team a couple of years ago? I mean, we're just seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it all across the league. Iowa State has a bunch too. Obviously, they're not a great example this year because of how bad they've been. But you don't have to look far throughout the league at teams that are not Kansas and not Texas, not elite, to find teams that are doing this regularly with success. And that is where, like, I need to see that evolution from this coaching staff. I need to see that evolution from this coaching staff to really feel comfortable about where this is headed. And I fear that this is an example of, as Bruce Weber has aged and still had success, by the way, because again, 2 years ago, he was winning the league. I understand that. But as he continues to age here and this becomes more and more of a way you have to do it and the way that you have to play, especially if you're in K-State's position and doubly especially if you're going to be blowing up your roster, the way that K-State did a couple of years ago, well, into last year, like, you have to be willing to evolve with that. And in what's going to be like a prove-it year, like a put-up-or-shut-up year, a you-should-be-coaching-for-your-job year next year, man, I want to see you go take that chance. I want to see you go hit the portal. Are there downsides to it? Sure. K-State's had some bad pulls. Mato Sala did not work. Like, we'll see on Casey Eziegu, but he's not been as impactful as I think they envisioned him being this year. But that doesn't mean that you just stop. I mean, it's the same, like, recruiting. Like, you recruit a high school kid, and one doesn't work out. Like, one turns into James Love. Do you just stop? Well, no, because, like, there's also Marcus Foster and Nigel Pack. Like, there are other guys that come in and do well with that. This team needs experience. They need to get older faster. That would help cut down on the turnovers. It would help mold some of the younger players. These guys that did not have Wesley Iwundu, DJ Johnson, Justin Edwards when they first came in. They need to get better at shooting the three, which is just frankly a trait that they don't have enough of. It's a commodity that they don't have enough of, and it's not something that you can just magically make appear on this team right now. As many shots as you want to try and put up in the gym, there's just not a lot of natural shooters on this team. These are things that need to be remedied in the transfer market. So I'm hopeful that we'll see that after the Iowa State game, after the Big 12 tournament, once the dust settles on the season and we know how many transfers are out there and what kind of numbers are going to be out there and available based on circumstances this year, I'm hoping that's a route that they go down. Because I don't think what they have right now makes me feel, well, I know that what they have right now doesn't make me feel confident that they're getting back to the middle of the pack in the Big 12 next year and legitimately competing for the NCAA tournament. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm not closing my eyes. You guys have to close your eyes. Close your eyes and imagine a scenario with me coming up next. So I want you all, if you would, should probably come in a little more calm and soothing here. Just a calm, soothing voice and presence for you. Close your eyes. Close your eyes. And I need you to imagine that a scheduling oddity has K-State playing the Kansas Jayhawks twice in the span of 72 hours. Twice in the span of 72 hours. It's like the old Big Monday turnaround, the classic Big Monday turnaround that, you know, K-State doesn't have to worry about too much anymore these days. It feels like forever ago. But you play Saturday night, potentially. You turn around and play Monday night. Both games, however, are against Kansas. One in Allen Fieldhouse. And then turn around and come back home. Or actually, in this scenario, I think I have it backwards. And it would be you play Kansas first at home and turn around and go play them in Allen Fieldhouse. Are you picturing this? Are your eyes closed? If your eyes are closed, thank you. Now, I want you to keep them closed and imagine this scenario if it works out like this. K-State wins game one with an epic performance. Say, a 40-point performance. If you would like, you could substitute the 38-point performance that Jacob Pullen once upon a time did drop on Kansas on a Big Monday turnaround in 2011. Okay, imagine that you get that kind of performance. And then 2 days later, you turn around and beat Kansas again. Okay? Now just picture what that looks like, feels like. Drink that all in. And imagine what that would be like. Now you can open your eyes. I'm done being a doctor. I'm done trying to be soothing there. That didn't really work very well for me. I hope that wasn't as weird for you as it was for me. But that's what Oklahoma State just went through, man. Imagine that. Imagine that. You just got to beat your arch rival, who is good this year, by the way, in Oklahoma, twice in the span of 72 hours, with one of those coming on a 40-point game from your star player. I am so jealous right now of Oklahoma State. Infinitely jealous of the Cowboys for getting to do that. Now, the scenario I laid out is different only in the fact that Kansas absolutely owns K-State in hoops. It's not quite the case with Oklahoma and Oklahoma State basketball, but if we're talking about like the general scope of the two schools, I mean, Oklahoma is in the same place as Kansas, and Oklahoma State is in the same place as K-State here, right? Like, there's more of an edge. There is that inferiority complex at play there between the two schools, and I'm just telling you what side of the aisle K-State's on. It's the same one as Oklahoma State. So you get the opportunity to go do that. That's great. That's good stuff. Like, that's what makes college athletics great. When you get those moments and you get those opportunities to go do that, I could not be happier for our Cowboy brethren. And not that I really take too much of a side between Oklahoma State and Oklahoma. I actually like watching Oklahoma football, you know, as much as the next average guy out there. I don't have a ton of hatred for them anymore these days. They're fun. They're good. They carry the flag and carry a lot of water for the Big 12. But I can recognize when another school is in the same type of position and be like, man, that would be awesome. And I know what that would feel like to this fan base and for everybody around here if that did happen. So I hope everybody has some appreciation for what happened with Oklahoma State and Oklahoma. Of course, Oklahoma State wrapping up the little mini sweep in their game last night when they played Oklahoma on Big Monday. And the Sooners now are really scrambling. 79-75 was the final there. And it also found it great that it's, you know, Cade Cunningham pops for 40, and then 2 days later, it's basically like a decoy. You know, just kind of a decoy, hanging out, letting everybody else do the work, letting Caleb Boone do the work. And, you know, he can be there, hit some key baskets, but just hang out. Just hang out. Cade Cunningham, just hang out, put up 17. That's what he does. Congratulations to the Cowboys. Like, Manhattan would be, I don't even know, you know, if we're talking non-COVID times. Like, can you imagine, like, K-State is a top 20 team and then goes and does that twice to Kansas? Like, what would the Ville be like? What would the Ville be like if K-State did that twice in a 72-hour period? That might be like selling out of Bud Light territory, which I've seen happen a couple of times on the road with K-State fans and Powercat game day. So, basketball is not in that position right now. That's a big part of the problem, why we've been spending most of the show today talking about transfers. And because basketball is in that situation, I think it's actually opened a unique door here for baseball. We don't talk a lot of K-State baseball, or baseball in general for that matter, here on this show. But I am sensing enough general interest out there right now that I do think it's fair to bring up here. The fact that I'm sensing that general interest from the fan base right now is exactly what's unique about this, and exactly why I say K-State baseball has a unique opportunity this year. I think they can seize some extra fan buy-in and obviously see some extra attention. But I think, like, what comes along with the attention and what's important about that is some extra fan buy-in by going out there and having a good season this year. Because I'm sure it's always here to an extent by now, but it gets there at least with baseball. But I don't ever really seem to see too much chatter about baseball, at least until it gets into Big 12 play. And the team, you know, has not been very good for a while now, since they won the Big 12 back in 2013. So that's been a part of it. But I think you have a unique mix of a lot of factors here right now that are giving this team a chance to, you know, it's kind of like just having more chips in the center of the table with a chance to cash all of that in and really exponentially grow what it is that you have in terms of fan interest and buy-in. Whereas usually when the team's not very good and basketball is better and more competitive still at this time of year and people aren't just like desperately searching for something to make them feel better about K-State athletics, combined with, you know, there's not typically a pandemic there that has people, I think, even more desperate to search for the feel-good elements here and, like, something that brings them back to, like, hey, my team can win. You just don't have as many chips to play with. K-State right now has a lot of chips out there on the table and a lot that can be riding on them being at least a competitive team this year in the Big 12 and flirting with a regional appearance. Because it is an angsty time in K-State athletic circles, right? Like, there was the stretch up until K-State beat TCU, which was, what, like the end of February? I mean, it was the end of October to the end of February with nothing exciting and pretty much all losing. Five basketball wins that were ultimately very meaningless. You can maybe classify the Iowa State game as fun, but that would be it. That's it. And so everybody here is like, God, wait, you're telling me the baseball team actually could be decent this year? Like, sign me up. I'm going to get interested. I'm going to start learning about Jordan Wicks. We have the Big 12 preseason pitcher of the year. All right, let me start looking up this guy. Let me start seeing where he's projected in mock drafts. Like, let me see where he's projected in the Major League Baseball draft coming up this year. I'm seeing a lot of that, which is awesome. I mean, as somebody that's been, you know, involved calling baseball games now at K-State since 2014. Ironically, the year after the Big 12 championship. All right, don't bring the pitchforks out at me. It's been very cool to see, and I recognize the opportunity that's here, where there's some extra spotlight, and there's some extra, I would just call it like some extra desire for a winner in anything. And so that gives the baseball team a chance to deliver when everybody else this year has not been able to deliver. Football started to, and I think probably still would have if Skylar Thompson didn't get hurt, but he did, and you can't change that. And it turned out throughout the season, wasn't much to deliver there. Basketball has never even come close to delivering, and in fact has done pretty much the complete opposite for most of the season. So now you're sitting here in baseball season, and like, all right, well, there is spring football, but it's a long time before that actually fires back up again. This has been a miserable year. Give me something to be excited about. Here's your chance, baseball. Here is your chance. And on top of that, another thing that's helping out now, as opposed to even a couple of years ago, is that you can watch so many of the games on Big 12 Now on ESPN+. You pay the $5 a month, you can watch every single home game, and, you know, depending, I don't know if you went and got Flow Baseball, but, like, there are some options for these other road games. And, like, I haven't even looked at what the Big 12 schedule is like. If every single game is on Big, that's something I should know. I apologize for not knowing that. But you'll have the opportunity, point being, to watch more of these games than you typically would have for a pretty cheap price. Like, it's pretty easy to do. I know some of you complain and whine and moan about the $5 a month, but it ain't that bad, okay? Could be a lot worse. And if it helps you get some jollies off here for the sports season when there have not been many to be had throughout the year, I think it's a price that a lot of people are willing to pay. And if you don't do that, hey, by the way, you can listen on News Radio KMAN the entire season. All right? It's a unique opportunity. And I don't even hesitate, like, in saying that and framing it in this way, because I think you could look at that and be like, well, hey, I mean, like, why put the extra pressure on him? Like, I don't – Pete Hughes is not a guy that I think worries much about that. Like, he came in here from day one and said, Omaha standard. Like, we're trying to play to an Omaha standard. And that was for a program that it's been at the bottom. It's been the worst program in the league since I started doing the games in 2014. That's the program he inherited, and he said Omaha standard from day one. He's not shying away from that. He's not afraid of any of that, and he's proving that he's not. He's going out and getting talent. He's got a hell of a starting rotation this year, by far the best that I've ever seen in my time at K-State. Like, the guy knows what he's doing. He doesn't shy away from it. He's not afraid. And that hopefully will permeate to the team. And I don't even think it takes them being a regional team necessarily. I don't think it takes them getting to Omaha. You know, I mean, I had somebody ask me yesterday, what's the legitimate ceiling for this team? And I said, I think being a regional team. I think that, like, has to be the hope, that you hope that this team can be good enough to get back to the postseason. And I think they do legitimately have that opportunity. And if they can play like that and at least just be in contention through Big 12 play, that will go a long way to regenerating interest in the program, and more so than would have even been there if, say, last year went off as normal without a hitch, no pandemic, and they had been a regional team last year. Or in particular, a couple of years ago when basketball was winning the Big 12 championship and there was still a lot to look forward to there. And there was a coaching change in football and just a lot of other things to distract you that were exciting and fun. Whereas right now, those distractions are all gone. Your focus can now be on baseball. And I'm sensing that people, just looking at social media, message boards, what people ask me, just word of mouth, the interest seems to be higher. And I think for all those reasons, this is the type of thing you need to cash in. I'm no good at poker or blackjack or anything like that, but it feels like when Mitch, when I went out with him and he used his little strategy of you lose and then you double down, and he was down to his last chance, hit big, wound up winning like $500 that night and was buying me burritos because I was out really quick. Hopefully K-State baseball is buying burritos by the end of this year. Mitch Lepke, a number one song of the day that he says I'll hate, coming up next. Mitch has never known me less than telling me that this was going to be a number one song that I would hate. I loved this song when it came out. Of course, 1998's My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. It was number one for 2 weeks. This is exactly why 1998 is the pinnacle of American society, and life will just never get better than it was in 1998. This is an evergreen take of mine. You'll hear it from me at any point. K-State football was just kicking ass and taking names. The economy was great. Business was booming for everybody. Commercials were great. Music and pop culture was awesome. And we had Titanic, and we had My Heart Will Go On. God, how could Mitch tell me I would hate this?
You sure he didn't mean it, like, figuratively, like, jokingly?
No. No, he did not. I asked
so
him.
So he was adamant.
I ask him a lot of times, like, when I'm handing him the outline right before the show, I'm like, will I love it or hate it? And he said, oh, you're gonna hate it.
Oh.
I said, oh, you're gonna hate it. I have some stories to tell about this. Let me get some biographical info in here first. My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. She is a singer from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Billboard named her the Queen of Adult Contemporary. All right. Queen of Hot AC, huh? She sold over 250 million albums. Wow, okay. Best-selling Canadian artist of all time. She was ranked at number 64 by VH1 on its list of 200 greatest pop culture icons of all time. All right. I mean, I knew Celine Dion was a big deal. This is making me feel like she was a bigger deal than I even realized. She's had 4 number one songs, 10 top 10 songs, and 27 studio albums. Now, here's what we need to get to. This was written for the movie Titanic. James Horner came up with the music for the song and scored the film. Horner was a very popular composer of orchestral music who wrote scores for many movies, including Braveheart, Apollo 13, and Aliens. All right, lyrics by da-da-da-da-da, whatever. Okay, this is what I have to tell you about this. When Titanic came out, 1998, I was 9 years old. And I wanted to see this movie so bad because it was a pop culture phenomenon. Like, everybody that I knew was seeing this. Everybody. Every kid that I went to class with had seen it and wouldn't shut up about it. And, like, I wanted to see it so bad. But the problem is, my parents had this little rule. And this rule was, I was not allowed to watch a PG-13 movie until I was 13 years old. And no sooner than that. 13 years old, hardline stance. Now, did I find some workarounds like watching The Bride of Chucky at a sleepover with a friend when I was like 6? Yes, I did. Did I find workarounds to the no parental advisory music? Like smuggling in Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock CDs? Yes, I did. But this was a tough one, because you have to actually go to the movie theater and, like, pay for the ticket. Like, I couldn't pull it off, and I was devastated. Like, this was up with the Dreamcast fiasco, where I so badly wanted a Sega Dreamcast for Christmas 1 year and was told no. And it was the most crushing Christmas I've ever had. It was one of the more crushing experiences of my childhood to not be able to see the movie Titanic when it actually came out. And I'm actually not sure that I've seen the whole thing all the way through. I think I've watched parts of it on TV now. I need to go back and actually watch this. And this is one that I would actually watch. One thing I do remember, though, what my mom tried to do to make me feel better. And so, like, this song was just popping. Everybody loved this song. And because the movie was so popular, I was like, well, the closest I can get is listening to Celine Dion, so I guess I'm going to do that. And my mom felt bad and one day picked me up from school. And what was waiting for me in the car? A tape. Excuse me, I was about to say a CD. A cassette tape of the Titanic soundtrack. A cassette tape of the Titanic soundtrack. And she popped it in, and we cranked up this song, My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion, as loud as it would possibly go. And I, you know what? All was better, at least for, like, how long is this song? 3 minutes, 30 seconds, something like that?
4 minutes and 8 seconds.
All right, for 4 minutes and 8 seconds, life was bliss. Everything was good. It made me feel like I was actually seeing the movie, even though I didn't. Celine Dion was Horner and Jennings' first choice to record the song. The version you hear in the movie was recorded in one take. Wow. She would re-record the song for her album release after the film's release. This was featured on two albums, Dion's fifth studio album, Let's Talk About Love, and the Titanic soundtrack. Listen to this. Man, life has changed. The Titanic soundtrack sold over 30 million copies. 30 million copies. I would love to know how many of those were cassette tapes like the one that my mom purchased me. Made it the fourth best-selling soundtrack of all time. My Heart Will Go On won the 1998 Academy Award for Best Original Song. It dominated the 1999 Grammys, winning Record of the Year. First to be won by a Canadian. Take that, Bret Hart. Where's your Grammy? Song of the Year, Best Female Pop Vocal Performance, and Best Song Written Specifically for a Motion Picture or Television Show. With worldwide sales estimated at over 18 million copies, it became the second best-selling single by a female artist in history. Number one, Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. Personally, I would take Celine Dion 10 times out of 10 over that. In December 2007, the song was placed at number 21 on VH1's 100 Greatest Songs of the 90s. Yeah, this needs to be really high up on the list of greatest songs of the 90s. This is 90s AF. 90s AF. This was ranked number 14 on AFI's 100 Years, 100 Songs, celebrating the 100 Greatest Songs in American Film History. The song has also received criticism. In 2011, Rolling Stone readers ranked it the seventh worst song of the 90s, and that's how Mitch's write-up ends? Rolling Stone, shove it. Shove it. Take Celine Dion, take that old cassette tape of mine, and shove it. It is not one of the worst songs of the 90s. How dare anybody suggest that, and how dare Mitch even include it in this write-up, let alone end on it. This song is a straight-up certified banger. It will forever live in banger infamy. And not only that, it continues to reinvent itself, like what we've seen on Twitter with the Twitter account that just takes clutch moments, big moments in games, and puts the Titanic soundtrack behind it at the crescendo when the big thing happens. How far are we into the song right now?
We still have roughly about a minute left on it.
Did I miss the big crescendo? The "You're here, there's nothing I fear"?
I think that's coming up, like, right now.
Ah. That part. That's what the Twitter account does. Like, when the game-winning shot goes in, it's right when you hear... I'm not going to sing it. I'm not even going to try. A lot of times I try and sing these songs for you. If it's Creed, I'll sing it on Friday. Not going to do it here today. But just know that I wanted to. And you should have been in your car. I'm glad that we got to share this experience together, guys. This was cathartic. I got to unload something that has plagued me since my childhood. And we got to all reminisce on how great 1998 was. And I tell you what, the treats are not done, because I've got a Jabroni of the Week for you coming up next.
And then everyone said, "Jabroni.
You jabronis hit the jackpot.
That jabroni you have sitting in your studio.
Ow.
Is this Jabroni's name?
Jabroni of the Week.
Here come the Cavs. I am Mitch Fortner with your Jabroni of the Week. You know how the game is played. I've got three jabrones, not the real jabrone, but then I've got the real jabrone after that. You know, so four kind of jabrones here. We do three dishonorable mentions, and then we get to the real jabrone. Mike McGurl. Mitch Fortner.
Spot on impression.
Jabroni number one. This guy is actually he's clowning on one of my good friends here. My buddy Josh Graham. He does radio out in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He asked Roy Williams a question after Roy Williams lost a dumb game to Marquette last week. A game that shouldn't have been scheduled in the first place. They did it 4 days in advance, a non-conference game, and they lost. And Roy Williams was a real jabrone to my buddy Josh Graham with the way he treated this question.
What would you say to Carolina fans who are questioning whether or not it made sense to schedule this game considering the result?
Well, if I'd known we were going to lose, God almighty, I wouldn't schedule the thing. Come on, we can't operate in damn hindsight. God almighty. If you'd told me we were going to lose, hell yeah, we wouldn't have played the game. If you'd told me we were going to beat the Lakers, I'd schedule them. Carolina fans. If they are, I got no answers for.
What?
And then he just walked off after that. Sorry for the laughing behind. It was a clip from Highly Questionable, but my man Josh is the real winner here because his clip got played on Highly Questionable and Around the Horn and all the different shows. So that's you're a real jabron. Dishonorable mention there, Roy Williams. Dishonorable mention number two. This is a guy that could probably be on here every single week. Yes, he's real good at his job. He does the sports talk thing. His name's Colin Coward. It is what he is. He's always doing stuff just to get a reaction out of people. I probably shouldn't react to it, but, just sometimes it happens. Selton Miguel! So Colin Coward, he did quarterback tiers. He was talking about, what quarterbacks are the best, and he had Patrick Mahomes as a second-tier quarterback in the NFL. I mean, what kind of jabroni take is that? Deshaun Watson, a second-tier quarterback, too, and Josh Allen in tier one. Enough with this Josh Allen stuff. Just jabroni. Honestly, I'm mad that I didn't make him the real jabroni after that one, but I have good reason for it. Here come the cats. Dishonorable mention number three. It's this guy named Ryan on Twitter. This guy named Ryan. He tweeted at Dave Pasch, an ESPN play-by-play guy. He said, "Whoever is on the call with Bill Walton right now is so much worse than at Dave Pasch." He even tagged him like a real tough guy. And Dave Pasch was actually on the call, and he just responded to the tweet and said, "Well, it was me." Ryan, you got clowned on by Dave Pasch. But you guys waited for it all week. Here it comes. Here go the cats. Mitch Fortner is our jabroni of the week because the guy hasn't had Call Hall ice cream. Can you believe that? This guy's lived in Manhattan for like a decade. He hasn't had Call Hall ice cream. That's a real jabroni move right there. So, somebody should probably bring us some Call Hall ice cream, just so Mitch can stop being a jabroni. And, That's jabroni of the week. That's how the game is played. Here come the cats!